Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am delighted to be joined today by two of my amazing Bruegel colleagues, Simone Tagliapietra and Flora Marchioro. We are going to be talking to you about energy, about the emissions trading system, about the big changes that are coming, and why the European Union is doing something so ambitious on this right now. Simone, we have the EU's climate policy under attack around the world. We have a 20-year-old ETS system that is now under review, plus a new system coming online. Where are we at right now?
Thank you, Rebecca. And indeed, this is an important year for EU climate policy for the very simple reason that the main instrument we have had in Europe for indeed two decades in this space, the emission trading system, the ETS, will undergo in the coming months a very important review. This is not the first time. This is the fifth review, I think, of the system by now. It's something that is enshrined into legislation. We need to do this regularly. And in the past, these reviews have always served the purpose of strengthening the tool, of strengthening the system, also by providing a sectorial expansion of it. Now, this year, of course, the discussion around the review of the ETS started in a very different manner, in a very different political mood, because early this year, we have seen political leaders attacking the system, calling for a substantial reduction in the price of emissions with the claim that this is necessary for industrial competitiveness. Now, at Bruegel, we are strong supporters of the ETS. We think that from an economic policy perspective, it is the instrument we need to deliver in a cost-efficient manner emissions reduction in our economy. And we think this is what we have seen happening actually over the last years, because the sectors that are covered by the ETS one, the system we have in place, have indeed been decarbonizing faster than other sectors. So together with Georg Zachmann, we have published in the last few months several pieces basically saying that watering down the ETS at this point in time would do very little to help industrial competitiveness, would actually harm industrial competitiveness in Europe, because the ETS is there to provide a price signal to investors about the fact that they need to decarbonize, they need to transform, because polluting in the future is going to cost more and more. And this transformation is just what we need in order to remain competitive also internationally, because others out there, starting with China, are moving very fast in this new clean tech industrial decarbonization sectors. So I think the narrative around the ETS should be a bit clearer on the fact that this is an ally of industrial competitiveness as a tool, is not something that goes against industrial competitiveness. And also when it comes to the interplay of the ETS and electricity prices, which is a specific item that has been under attack by some governments over the last years and months, I think it is important to make clear statement that the ETS is not the problem of high electricity prices in Europe. The problem of high electricity prices in Europe is the role of natural gas, which is, of course, expensive and volatile due to the geopolitical trends we have out there. And what the ETS does is also, by the way, to foster the rollout of renewables into the power generation system. And therefore, the ETS, again, is a tool that helps you to lower the volatility of the electricity prices moving forward, as more and more renewables and nuclear, of course, will play an important role into the system versus volatile and geopolitically exposed fossil fuels like natural gas. But we can come back to that later if you want.
Thank you so much for laying that out. It's such a different way of thinking about it than the last energy podcast we did, which was looking with Georg Zachmann. It was wonderful. We were looking really at credits and how they are allocated within the EU and how they are or not accepted from outside the EU. And so I love that you brought it back to energy prices. Is this really affecting the energy prices or not? And what is our actual goal? How is this helping us switch to renewable energy and help with the green transition? Do you think that ETS is more self-sustaining from a private sector perspective right now? Or do you think that the role of governments and goal setting still is key to how it accomplishes all of its different missions?
I think it is important to clarify that a sound climate policy is a climate policy that uses different levers to move the economy towards decarbonization. The price signal that the ETS provides is possibly the most important among the levers we have, because that is what we define, no, in economics as playing with expectation. You provide a sense of direction to investors. They internalize this and therefore switch their investment preferences today in light of higher cost of polluting tomorrow. Of course, this is not sufficient per se. We need a climate policy toolkit that has carbon pricing alongside other instruments, including innovation support. So subsidies for innovation are, of course, a key ingredient here for sure. We need regulations. So regulations like CO2 standards, for example, in cars are very important tools to lead the decarbonization of certain segments that, by the way, so far have not been covered by the ETS, like road transport. And we need financing. We need investment support, generally speaking. So I think it's a mix of instruments that allow a cost-efficient decarbonization pathway in Europe. That's what we are seeing already. We just need to make sure that we get the nature of these instruments right, and we do not try to water them down on the assumption that doing so would help our industry, because that is not the case. I think it needs to be very clear to all today that climate policy we need to do in Europe, not just because of climate, and allow me to say this, but of course, I mean, that would be per se already a super important reason, but it's just not because of that any longer. It's because of industrial competitiveness, and it's because of security reasons, and namely our need to rapidly reduce our import dependency on fossil fuels. That's what climate policy can deliver to you today.
Thank you so much. We at Bruegel, by which I mean the two of you and your colleagues, are doing some amazing work on how this is playing out in the real economy. So let me just ask you, Flora, what's at stake in the ETS1 review?
The debate right now, especially the political debate, is very muddied because two questions are currently being conflated. So whether the ETS delivered the system level emission reductions that it was supposed to do, and it did so specifically in the power sector. And the second question is whether it adequately supported the firm level decarbonization. And it was not supposed to do this alone. And in this sense, the revenue is kind of playing around this conundrum. The reform by itself, the legal reasoning why we need the reform is that there were 2040 targets, decarbonization target approved in the last month, and the ETS needs to recalibrate for these new targets. So we now have a clear target of reduction of domestic emissions by 2040 to -90% compared to 1990s levels. 5% of this reduction will come through international credits, and the ETS is trying to understand whether these international credits can be included in the revision, so can be part of the cap that is covered by the ETS1. So far, the answer is no. So far, one of the points for which the Commission is pretty strong on is indeed whether international credits will be included or not within the ETS cap. They're going to provide some flexibility, yes, but they're not going to probably be included in the ETS. So on top of understanding this free allocation and revenue dilemma, I would say, so understanding where conditionality should be introduced more strongly, and on top of understanding the scope and international credits role within the ETS, there's clearly the revision of the cap and the trajectory related to these 2040 new targets. And finally, a reform that was briefly mentioned on the market stability reserve. So the fact that as of now, the market stability reserve was used mostly as a tool to withdraw carbon credits from the market to allow the market not to be overflooded with permits. As of now, 1st of April 2026, the Commission proposed to stop the invalidation of these allowances, indeed to support the decarbonization for the next decade, because we are not going to have an issue, most likely, of too many permits being in the market, but actually the opposite. So too little permits being there, and industry and polluting plants being kind of vocal in trying to make sure that that's not going to be the case. So we need a mechanism that kind of brings back permits to the system.
Flora, tell us about some of the research that you and Simone and your Bruegel colleagues are doing to assess and advise on how these reviews are going to go?
What we're doing here at Bruegel is mostly following the reform of the ETS1 that is expected to be proposed by the Commission around mid-July, so around the 15th of July this year. And related to that, we're looking specifically at an issue, which is the use of revenues that is becoming more and more prevalent in the debate right now. So following the question of where this money is going and whether it's actually supporting industrial decarbonization or not. Let me give you a brief overview of what we know so far and what the ETS has achieved so far. It has reduced emissions since its inception in 2005. By around 47 to 50%. So we are in line with the targets by 2030. We managed to decouple emissions from economic growth. And the beauty of the ETS is indeed that it allowed to do so in line with the sectors that have a least expensive cost of reducing emissions. So the emission reduction came from sectors that had like lower decarbonization costs. And in this case, it was mostly about the power sector. So in the past 20 years, it was mostly the power sector from a switch from coal to a gas, and then from renewable deployment. The question is now what to do with industry, with hard-to-abate industry that decarbonized more slowly. We even have sectors like aviation that has been introduced in the ETS within intra-EU flights. Aviation increased emissions, industry instead decarbonized more slowly. And the question is now how to support industry to decarbonize faster. Related to this, the push is very much related to the revenue side. So in the ETS, as of 2013, the system moved from a system of mostly free allocated allowances to a system of auction allowances. It means that there is a primary market in the platform EEX, primary market where auctions are set weekly. So as of 2013, free allocation has been slowly phased out, mostly for power generators, meaning that power generator plants need to pay for all of the carbon credits and so the emissions that they produce. For industry, this has not been the case fully so far. There's still 85% of emissions being allocated through free allocation, but auctioning is getting more and more as a default method. That means that through auctioning, the European Commission is collecting revenues that are then redistributed either to EU funds or to member states. So far, so as of 2013 mostly, around 260 billion of revenues have been collected, and around 75% of these revenues have been redistributed to member states through auction shares that have been predefined based on historical emissions of the member states. So now the question is, we know that a quarter of these revenues is staying at the EU level in order to fund funds like the Modernization Fund or the Investment Fund, and the remaining part of the revenues is going to member states. As of 2023, member states have a conditionality on these revenues, so they need to spend 100% of these revenues on decarbonization purposes, either energy or industry. The list of these purposes is extremely long. It includes efficient housing, it includes electric vehicles, it includes indeed industrial decarbonization investment, it also includes grid deployment. So it's extremely broad. And the situation that we're seeing right now is that most member states are actually putting the money very close to the mostly power and power decarbonization purposes, and the industry is kind of left out in a sense. And that's why the industry is right now being very, very vocal in asking for strong understanding of, first of all, where these revenues are going. There is huge transparency issues that we show in our analysis on how different member states are earmarking these revenues. And on top of that, what is the actual purpose of this revenue? Where should these money go to? Should they go to the low-hanging fruits of decarbonization, or should they provide a support for those hard-to-abate industries that are not decarbonizing fast enough due to the price not being high enough for them?
Thank you, first of all, for that explanation of how ETS works and how we move from allocations to auctions, because I know I appreciate the review on that. Maybe our listeners will as well. I want to ask about the money and the trade-offs between the politics of this and the effectiveness of this. I often encounter this revenue on the budget side where people say, wouldn't it be great if we could make ETS an own resource? It would go into the EU budget, and then we could allocate it with all the rest of the EU budget to wherever people need to put their money. And then you have the other side where member states say, look, if we have to collect it, we need to keep some of it. And then you have the policy side of saying, well, if it's money that's supposed to be about curtailing emissions, can't we use it for the green transition? And all of these constituencies have to be taken into account, plus the producers, as you said. Simone, how do you walk through this thicket of considerations and all of these people wanting to spend the same money over and over again?
But to me, the situation here is pretty straightforward from an economic policy perspective, but also from a political perspective, I would say increasingly so. We have a principle, which is that pollution needs to have a price. So we tax basically the pollution through a cap and trade system. That is the ETS. Now, the idea here is that is the one of carbon dividends. We need to put a price on pollution, and at the same time, we need to use the revenues that we that the system generates in order to foster the transformation of these sectors that have to pay for this price of the pollution in order for them to lower their pollution over time. So I think the idea here is not a system that wants to punish, but is a system that wants to ignite a transformation and support with this transformation, not only the decarbonization objective we have, but also the industrial policy objective, the competitiveness objectives we have. So to me, it is straightforward. From an economic perspective, that the revenues of the emission trading system need to go back to those that have to pay for this system in order for them to transform. Now, it happens that exactly as Flora clearly illustrated, this has not been the case in the past. These 260 billion in revenues that the ETS has generated so far over the last two decades, predominantly retained at the national level, have been used by countries for purposes that have nothing to do with decarbonization and, in specific, with industrial decarbonization. So certain countries just pull these revenues into the general budgets to repay the debt and all sorts of measures. This is not possible, in my view. I think the Commission did it right to introduce a certain degree of conditionality in the previous review of the ETS, but that was too soft. So I think with this review, it would be very important for the Commission, and I understand that is the willingness there, and of course this will find also strong support in the European Parliament, is to say now governments really need to use these revenues they are accruing for industrial decarbonization. And this would be, of course, very important, again, not only to foster the transformation of the industry, but also the competitiveness we want to achieve.
So can we think of the trade-off between being an EU-level own resource or allowing it to stay with member states really on the terms that they must use it for decarbonization? Is that one of the key trade-offs?
Yes, that's exactly the case right now. So I see that one of the key trade-offs that is currently discussed in the reform is the fact that there is conditionality that can be put through in two ways. The first one is through free allocation conditionality on investment. This is something that has been introduced in the past revision of the ETS, and it has been successful for some sectors like district heating. So it is indeed the case that the Commission is considering keeping the kind of the battle in their own hands and keeping the power in their own hands by, instead of checking more conditionality at the member state, using the free allocations as a way to retain kind of a direction of where this possible money is going. So strengthening and introducing for certain sectors that are not covered by it, free allocation conditionality on investment is something that the Commission is considering very much. The second way is indeed the revenue earmarking. So requiring member states to earmark whatever revenues they're getting from ETS auctions for specific reasons. As I said before, so far the list as of 2023 has been very broad. This means that according to the European Commission, just 5% of the revenues so far have been used for industrial decarbonization process of incumbent, meaning of plants that are covered by the ETS mostly. And that cannot be the case going forward, especially thinking that the ETS right now is mature enough that it's used more and more as an instrument that directs investment and not just reduces sectoral emissions. So yeah, the easy part has been done with decarbonizing electrification. And now understanding how to use ETS as an investment measure is the next big challenge. And in this, again, the one trade-off that you already pointed out is indeed this trade-off between the European Commission and the member states, so where the power stands. The other element is indeed on the scope of these revenues. So there is a trade-off between keeping the money to fund decarbonization in the power sector, so increasing grid deployment, renewable deployment, versus doing it for the industry, redirecting this money for the industry. Clearly, the power sector is the low-hanging fruit as of now. The power industry is the one that needs to be decarbonized by 2040 or a bit after that, and we really don't have and it needs huge investments for that. So that's the second trade-off that we're currently seeing.
In Brussels over the last year, simplification has been a big theme, trying to reduce the complexity of EU regulations. And critics of this process would say that it's also been about deregulation, about watering down the EU regulations. How does the ETS review and proposed changes, how does that process fit into this simplification, deregulation set of goals and concerns?
So you're right, Rebecca, to say that many out there see the deregulation push with the omnibuses, etc., to have some critical aspects, namely the fact that, for example, in the sustainable finance space, you create a lot of uncertainty, a lot of chaos, and, you know, investors find themselves in a more difficult position as they see uncertainty around them on the regulatory framework, which is supposed to be conducive for long-term green investments we need for our climate objectives. Now, I think that the ETS review is, of course, filed under a different item here, because this is something that we, as I said at the beginning, we need to do as an ordinary procedure over time. So this is not a part of this deregulation push. What is part, I think, of the overall simplification / provision of more flexibility, if you want to put it that way, modality that we have seen out of the European Commission over the last couple of years, I would certainly say is the ETS 2. Because, as you know, after the successful experience with the ETS 1 covering the energy intensive industries, power generation, intra-European aviation, etc., the Commission has launched a second ETS to basically cover road transport and the building sector that so far do not have a price for the pollution they generate. And this ETS 2 was meant to enter into operation in 2027. Now, as a result of this modality that we are discussing, the ETS 2 has been postponed by 1 year. So the entry into force is now 2028. And again, this postponement has been based on the assumption that we need to provide more time, more flexibility to countries to start adjusting in order to get there.
In the next part of our podcast, I want to talk more about ETS 2, why it was conceived of, and what this delay does to the Commission's goal for the process. Simone, can you tell us a little bit more?
Yes. So the ETS 2 is, as I said, a system that will cover road transport and the building sector. And the idea is to exactly replicate the experience of the ETS 1. So introducing basically a price on the pollution generated in these sector in these sectors in order to foster their decarbonization. Let's remember that these sectors are indeed those that are struggling to decarbonize. These are the sectors where we really need to accelerate decarbonization if we want to get to our climate targets. Now, I think discussing transport, in particular decarbonization, but also buildings decarbonization today, given the current geopolitical situation we have with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the related energy crisis, it's even more timely than before, because this is a clear example of how this instrument could align very well with the need of Europe for a new model in response to the new geopolitical reality. What we see out of the Middle East is an oil shock that is structural by now. All analyses point to the fact that this situation is going to be with us at least until next year. And we at Bruegel will soon publish also our own analysis of the situation. And we think this is serious. And it is now even more pressing than before for Europe to diminish our reliance on oil imports. Now, oil means predominantly transportation. Transportation is the sector where we consume most of the oil we need in Europe. And the way to get rid of oil or diminish our reliance on oil in this sector is by fostering alternatives. And the most important alternative is, of course, electric vehicles. So the ETS2 is a system that over time will add a further incentive exactly to move in this direction. Now, the social dimension of pricing pollution in transport and buildings has been in Europe politically well known since the Gilets Jaunes, which we all remember as a phenomenon in France, right? When Macron back then tried to introduce in France a form of carbon tax into the transportation sector. Now, based on that experience and based also, I would say, on the economic literature, the European Commission has been very cautious over the last years in the design of the ETS2. The idea being that the system should enter into force in a very smooth manner. So the system, the ETS2, has been designed with a rule-based market stability reserve that mitigates insufficient or excessive supply of allowances to the market, in order, in particular, for the first 2 years of the system operation, to make sure that if the price of allowances exceed 45 euro per ton, then additional allowances are released from the ETS2 market stability reserves, so to address the excessive price increases. So there is a mechanism to make sure that the price doesn't go beyond 45 euro per ton over the first 2 years of the system being entered into force. And this is a provision to make sure that there is no price shock at the very beginning of the system. So we allow for a smooth entry into operation. This was the first measure that was adopted by the Commission in the design of the ETS2. And the second one, which I think is very important, is the front-loading of the revenues in order to allow for investments into buildings and transport decarbonization to happen even before the system enters into play. And I'm referring here to the front-loading facility that the Commission built with the European Investment Bank, which amounts to 3 billion. And I also think about the Social Climate Fund that has been created in the framework of the ETS2 and that will enter into operation a year before the entry into force of the system in itself. So the ETS2, just to provide a few clear numbers, is expected between 2028 and 2032 to generate somewhere in between 350 and 550 billion euros in revenues, depending on the level of the price, which we don't fully know today, of course. So it's 550 billion that, you know, could be generated as a revenue by the ETS2. Most of these revenues will be retained at the national level in order to be used for the decarbonization of transport and buildings. And some of these will be channeled into a newly created EU fund called Social Climate Fund, 65 billion euro, in order to have a European instrument to drive also the decarbonization of these sectors. Now, what we currently see is that governments are struggling to table their own national plans on how to use these revenues. So the Commission asked countries, okay, come up with your social climate plans. So tell us how you will use the revenues in order to foster decarbonization of transport and buildings. And we will then make sure that the revenues are used in a sound manner at the national level, and that the Social Climate Fund is also used for the top-up part in a strong manner. Now, what we see is that member states were supposed to give these plans to the Commission by the summer of last year. Up to date, only 8 countries have submitted this social climate plan. So you see that countries are lagging behind. Only recently, Spain, for example, has come forward with its own plan, which was recently announced by Sanchez. We have other countries that are expected, of course, to come up with their own plans over the next months. But the system is low, and it tells about the difficulty of governments to identify measures to spur the uptake of electric vehicles or buildings decarbonization in a cost-efficient manner. Now, it turns out that these measures are exactly the same measures that we today need urgently in order to tackle the energy crisis. And the fact that oil over the next months and possibly year is going to be much higher in price than today, and we might even have to face certain degree of scarcity into the system, starting with the jet fuel sector. So this is to say that what used to be like long-term difficult climate policy making becomes today the same kind of response we need for short-term shocks as those we see in the Middle East, starting with a sector like road transport, where we consume most of our oil. And that's where I think we can illustrate how the climate agenda aligns perfectly with our security agenda.
Flora, what's your take on the simplification question in light of adding this new system that does seem to have a lot of important roles to play, but that also is proving very difficult for people to adjust to?
May I just add one thing to what Simone was saying? So we see the same kind of situation with the ETS 1 year of revenues. So the fact that there was recently a report from ECHO, a think tank from Italy, reporting that Italy used some energy bill relief for the 2022 crisis, and they reported them under the ETS 1 use of revenues. So we actually see this contrast between ETS 1 and ETS 2 scope and objectives that is watering down the money that is at ETS 1 and needs to be in some way just directed to ETS 2. Of course, it's not that easy to do that because public money is fungible. So you cannot really trace where this money is coming from and where it's going. And on top of that, the issue that makes this fungibility problem even worse for climate-related revenues is the fact that none of these measures can actually trace additionality of investment. It's not really possible to improve, like by improving traceability of the money and understanding where the money is invested, earmarking the revenues, ring-fencing the revenues, you don't really make sure that this is not money that would have been invested anyways. And that's kind of the additional issue.
That makes a lot of sense. You don't want the government to interfere with green transition that was going to happen anyway. You want to add some additionality and you want to make sure that you're putting extra stuff into the system. In the last part of our podcast, I want to look at how the EU system fits in with the broader world. Simone, what is the geopolitical context here, particularly with the US backlash against trying to combat climate change and China's many policy objectives that are not always aligned with what the EU has in mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the EU finds itself, you know, in a difficult position of basically being squeezed between an aggressive US policy course, where, of course, we have an extremely different take currently on all things related to climate than in the previous administration. I need to say, I mean, we have an US administration that is actively engaged in dismantling global efforts on climate action. And on the other end, of course, we have China and, you know, its industrial policies and all the things related to the so-called China Shock 2.0 that are now at the top of the concerns in Brussels. Now, in my opinion, the difficult balancing act that the EU needs to do here is between the three objectives of decarbonization, economic security, and competitiveness. And this is a difficult balancing act that requires careful assessment, namely when looking at the issue of clean tech and how Europe could or should reduce its reliance on China. There is a certain tendency, I think also partially reflected in the policy proposals of the Commission, like the Industrial Accelerator Act, to try to, you know, react to these fears about the over-reliance on China with a sort of across-the-board industrial policy effort where we try to basically import substitute all the clean technologies we need for the transition in order to make ourselves secure vis-a-vis the potential weaponization of these clean technologies and critical raw materials underpinning them by China. I think this is, of course, not going to be possible. I think the only way for Europe to have an efficient and effective industrial policy in this space is to be granular, is to identify where Europe has comparative advantages to build on, and is to identify how to handle those supply chains, those technologies where we do not have a comparative advantage. We need to continue to import at scale from China, but at the same time, trying to make ourselves more resilient. I think in particular, this implies to look into the supply chains, individual supply chains, and identify the key spots of vulnerabilities. Let me make one example, being the solar panels sector. Solar panels is a sector where Europe basically has little comparative advantage, I would say, where China, of course, has economies of scale that are extremely difficult, if not impossible, to replicate. And for Europe, it is about decarbonization speed. It is also about energy security, because the more we roll out, the less we need to import fossil fuels. So importing cheap solar panels from China makes sense for Europe under several perspectives. But we have these economic security risks that is namely entailed by the fact that the technology might be remotely controlled, all the literature around the kill switches, which point to the fact that the inverter are the core element of vulnerability in the solar panels, and that's where we need to be cautious, and we need to try to have these inverters Europeans or at least non-Chinese. The European Commission has recently introduced basically a provision banning the provision of EU subsidies to solar projects that include Chinese inverters. I think this methodology will be also applied by others, including the EIB, moving forward. It is welcome. Good that we target the specific point of vulnerability. But then the question is, do we have a European industrial policy to foster the manufacturing of inverters in Europe? And the answer today is no. And I think that's a mistake. I think that's exactly what we need to target. And that's our critique, no, of the Industrial Accelerator Act. We recently published a paper at Bruegel with Ignacio Garcia Bercero and Ben McWilliams on this subject, where we say, look, the Industrial Accelerator Act still lacks the granularity to be effective. In the case of the solar industry, that's clear. We cannot have an industrial policy for solar panels in Europe. It's unlikely to really work. We need to focus on the inverters production, and we need to make sure that we are secure, because this intelligent part of the panel is European, and therefore we are safer if we go down that route. I think this cybersecurity dimension, which, by the way, the US has used very strongly in the past, already with the Biden administration, to protect against these risks, is something that we need to also get better at. And that's where I would hope our industrial policy efforts will move in the next months and a few years.
That's a very powerful recommendation coming from you, because you've been, with colleagues, one of the louder voices calling against indiscriminate subsidies for the solar panel industry. We had a big paper while back saying the solar panels are now being manufactured in China and the EU should focus on deployment rather than trying to replace an industry that has moved on. So to come back and say, okay, this is the specific part that is mission critical that we need to do here, that we have reasons of autonomy to produce here, I think that's a big change. Do you feel like this would be a big shift in the public debate from focusing on just, do we try to reinvent the solar panel in Europe again or not? Or now pick this very specific thing that we care about?
I think so. I think we need to give this industrial policy effort a realistic touch. and stop giving the idea that we can try to support everything at the same time. That's not going to work. There are trade-offs here, and we need to acknowledge the trade-offs. By the way, fiscal constraints being part of these trade-offs, right? And that calls for selection. By the way, not to say, but the Draghi report when discussing clean tech really started with this clear identification of the segments where we do have a comparative advantage, we need to support, we need to give breathing space, makes sense to have trade measures, but there are other sectors where we need to deal with the problem differently. So I think that's the step that our policymakers need to take. Of course, industrial policy is difficult because the lobby power of the industry is very strong, and everybody wants to be part of this list that the Commission comes up with. And I think requires a degree of solid response by the policymakers that is difficult but necessary. So I think this is something that we will really need to do if we want to make sure that our policy is there to meet the decarbonization objectives and, again, the competitiveness objective and the security objectives we have.
Thanks for that. So how does the EU become more competitive worldwide? And how, in particular, is it managing what they call carbon leakage, this idea that if it's more expensive with ETS to produce in the EU, that they just move the production somewhere else? We have this new carbon border adjustment mechanism, which was pronounced CBAM. Is that working?
Yes. So thank you for the question. I wanted to first put a disclaimer on this because recently there are two debates that are conflated more and more. The one on competitiveness. So what is happening to EU firms compared to firms outside the EU that are not covered by the ETS? So are they losing sales? Are they losing jobs? Are they losing profits? Are they losing market share? And instead, the carbon leakage, which relates specifically to movement of emissions outside. So it's not necessarily related to the production, but it's specifically related to emissions moving somewhere else. And in this term, first of all, there's no clear-cut measure to measure any of them. There's no single agreed way of how to measure competitiveness or carbon leakage. So comparisons across studies, even in the academic background, they need to be taken with some care. That being said, it is true that up until 2013, not much has happened in terms of this carbon leakage and competitiveness issue. Multiple studies support that the main reasons for this is the low carbon price related to the overallocation of permits. As of 2013, instead, we actually start seeing that the picture gets a bit messier. So there are a bunch of studies that kind of support the issue and the question on what is happening in terms of competitiveness. Studies that use mostly trade data, macro data, foreign producer data, input-output data. And we see different types of carbon leakage or competitiveness concern if you want to use them interchangeably, even though they are not really the same thing. The first one would be that foreign producers gain market share compared to EU producers. The second way that this carbon leakage can actually play out is not necessarily that EU firms are relocating. That's not much what the literature is seeing, but it's more a question on where they're buying their inputs. So switching to inputs that are more carbon intensive. And that's, I would say, a more subtle way, which is not fully covered by CBAM as of now. That's indeed a question that's up for the reform, and specifically a question that industrial producers and plants covered by ETS are requesting the Commission to actually take more seriously. So we right now have CBAM that is looking at imports. It's not fully looking at exports, and it's not specifically fully looking at the full supply chain of these products. So if we don't want to take a strong stance on what are the lead markets, what we want to produce internally and what we want to buy from the outside, then we need to really start understanding how to make this CBAM work so that it at least covers the full supply chain.
Flora, for people who are outside this system, what is the one thing you would like them to take away about these major changes to the ETS system, both the review and the new one? What's the big picture concept that people should keep in mind here?
So the big picture that I would say anyone should really focus on right now is that so far the ETS has worked in reducing emissions where it was least costly to do so, mostly power generation. It was not meant to actually be an investment booster, although investment booster is one of the reform element that is going to be introduced together with the Industrial Decarbonization Bank. But the issue at stake is not much whether the ETS worked so far, but it's more how to make it work for the next big challenges. And the next big challenges are providing investment, ensuring that there is decarbonization investment without using too many public finances that do not come from within the system. And that's the big check. To make sure that this is actually the case, we need a price mechanism that is stable and consistent and is predictable for the future. So the recent attacks that we've been seeing from the Poland side, but also from the Italian side, which are, by the way, two of the biggest three beneficiaries of ETS revenues, are actually counterproductive in the sense that they are reducing the price mechanism, they are rewarding people and they are rewarding firms that waited for these investments, and they are actually punishing the front runners of decarbonization that we actually would want to support. So we hope not to see this happening further.
Thank you for that. It really brings us back to what Simone was saying at the beginning about the way to deal with the energy crisis is to move ahead with electrification and not just to let go of some of our revenue raisers and hope that it all works out in a short-term price-sensitive reaction. It's really good that you guys and your colleagues are taking such a long-term view towards these instruments and how they can really help. Listeners, thank you for being with us today. We are from Bruegel talking about the sound of economics. That's this podcast. My guests today have been Simone Tagliapietra and Flora Marchioro. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. We will link to some of their research in the show notes. You can find it for free on our website, along with all the podcast archives. Thank you for joining us, and see you next time.